Around Comics, episode 76.
Chicago, this is Around Comics, a roundtable discussing topics in and around the world of comics. I'm your host, Christopher Niesman, and I'm joined, as always, by the co-host of the show, Mr. Brian Salazar.
Hello.
And Mr. Tom Caters.
Boo!
It's not Halloween. Halloween.
What are you doing?
We recorded this October 15th. Nah, I'm sorry.
Head in the can for...
It's in the can for months. Mark yeah. Guggenheim.
It's just aging like a fine cheese. Yeah. Now it's stinky.
Yeah.
It's See, aging. All of our fine prognosticating. I think the Bears are going to do well this year, but fall just short.
Just short. So, Rex Grossman.
All right. Enough of that player. I can't
it's
even...
It's tough to be a white quarterback.
Okay, Rush.
As you just heard Tom say a second ago, Mark Guggenheim is who we're talking to today. So we'll get to that in just a couple minutes. But first of all, I want to let you know that this episode of Around Comics is sponsored by Borders.
Your heart pounds, your palms sweat, the tension is nearly unbearable. And then you spot it, the graphic novel you've been searching for everywhere, right here in your local Borders. Borders is your source for the best original graphic novels, manga, deluxe hardcovers, and trade paperback collections. Not only will you find exactly what you are looking for, you'll discover unexpected new authors and series. While you're at Borders, don't forget to check out their huge selection of music, movies, and magazines. Borders isn't just a bookstore, it has everything you need for your comics culture lifestyle. Now you can save on your favorite graphic novels, manga, and more. Google Borders for a valuable coupon, and always remember to check Borders first. To find a store near you, go to www.borderstores.com.
Or ask anyone on the street.
Or go to aroundcomics.com.
That's their new promotion, is everyone on the street knows
where the nearest Borders
yep.
is.
If, you just have to ask.
Everyone who's anyone.
Anybody who's anybody.
Or, I bet Mark Guggenheim can find you at Borders.
I'm sure he knows where they are. Or as Sal said,
call him and ask.
You can check our site. All right. Gravy. All right, folks, this is, we are getting extremely close to New York.
By the time you hear this, we're in New York, probably. We'll be on our way to New York.
We'll be on our way. Yeah, are you guys scared of flying, either one of you?
No.
Okay, cool.
Although I have not been...
I can't stand people that are scared of flying.
I have no fear of flying. It's
landing.
No. No, but I have not been on a plane since pre-9/11. I have not been on a plane...
It's totally different now.
That's what I've heard.
Almost always taken over by terrorists.
But not because of...
Almost always.
But not because of fear. I just haven't gone... I haven't gone anywhere.
So. I'm really glad neither one of you are scared of flying.
No.
Because nothing annoys me more than someone who has an irrational fear of flight.
I don't.
Sorry, fans.
But that's, I mean, uncontrollable. You can't, like...
All right. Well, why are we going to New York?
We're going to New York for the New York Comic Con, hosted at the Jacob Javits Center, February 23rd through the 25th.
Absolutely. 6th. And what are we going to be doing while we're there?
We're going to have signings with people like...
Hugathons.
Gregor.
Oh, good gravy. We are partnering with the Hero Initiative. And if you're not aware of who the Hero Initiative is, you certainly should. They create a financial safety net for yesterday's creators who may need emergency medical aid, financial support for essentials of life, and an avenue back into paying work. It's a chance for all of us to give something back to the people who have given us so much enjoyment. For more information on the Hero Initiative, please visit www.heroinitiative.org or call 310-909-7809.
And can I say, if you're not going to make it out to the New York Comic Con, which we'll be at, and we're going to have a bunch of stuff going on to benefit Heroes, and you want to give anyway, you can always go to the Heroes website and donate there. They have PayPal donation links that you can... Give a few bucks. It doesn't matter if it's, you know, $1 or $10 or $100, whatever you can give. It really goes to a good cause.
If every one of our listeners gave $1 over the next weekend...
That would be $7.
Maybe eight.
Oh.
But whatever it would be, it would make a huge difference in the life of a veteran creator.
What's the conversion rate from Australian money to U.S. money?
Oh, all right. Well, folks, we're going to be taking donations all weekend long. You've heard about this for a couple months
now. If you give a donation, I will buy you a shot if you're over 21.
There you go. You heard it here.
Wow, Tom. You know, a lot of people are going to be...
I don't care.
All right.
At our table, we have a lot of people helping us out. If you drop by, we'll be at table A152 in the Podcasters Arena. We're going to have such people as Athena Voltaire, artist and co-creator Steve Bryant, the colorist of Athena Voltaire, Mr. Jason Millay.
Who I went to high school with.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you did. And I went to high school with his girlfriend.
Yeah.
In Southern Illinois.
How strange is that?
Very, very weird. The author of The Other Side and
Welcome
Scalp,
to the Facebook
Jason
podcast.
Aaron. The artist of The Other Side, Cameron Stewart. The artist of The All New Adam and our good buddy, Mr. Mike Norton. Sean McKeever just signed up, so Sean will be at our table. Legendary creator Gene Colwin. And by special arrangement from Vanguard Productions, Carmine Infantino.
Hey, Chris, I heard recently that there's been a new...
Did we miss somebody?
New guest that has agreed.
That
we missed somebody on the list, and somebody you might be interested in. I don't know if you've ever read any of his work. A gentleman by the name of Greg Rucka.
Get out of town.
Is going to kick off the Comic-Con with us on Friday evening from 4 to 4:45.
The Greg Rucka robot has carved a chair out of platinum. For Mr. Rucka to sit on.
Greg's,
have you seen Sandbaggers?
Greg has Greg is kind enough to stop by our table at the Comic-Con on Friday.
4 o'clock on Friday.
Yeah, 4 o'clock on Friday. Come by, see us, see Greg, get something signed, and say hello and donate to Hero, and that's going to start off the con for us.
It's going to be good stuff. In addition to all those signings, we're also going to be selling original artwork, sketches, signed memorabilia from such people as Steve Rude, Chris Somney, who is just gone just out of control.
You can't
stuff.
Stop him. He's like
is he obsessive
freaky,
compulsive?
I think he's got some OCD issues. Because
if you live near Chris Somney, go check on him.
Chris is awesome. just don't give him a really sharp pizza cutter. He can do some damage with that. Ryan Stegman has offered to send some stuff. As have Mike Norton, Tim Seeley, Scotty Young, Steve Bryant, Greg Titus, Pat Loika, Scott Johnson. Dark Tower Comics is sending us with all sorts of stuff.
All sorts of good stuff. And thank you to everybody that's donated. And we wanna hopefully get rid of everything and give all that money to Hero.
And you can expect the bill for shipping shortly.
And just to give you a little preview, I don't totally expect an episode to be out on Monday. It's going to be probably later in the day, if at all, but maybe Tuesday. We start our convention wrap-ups.
It may be Monday evening, but we'll see how...
We're coming back late on Sunday.
Yeah. Go start from the beginning.
You'll catch up just in time.
Yeah, you'll catch up in time.
All right, guys. Around Comics is recorded every Friday at 7 o'clock at Dark Tower Comics and Collectibles, located at 4835 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. If you're in the area, please drop by. While you're here, ask Dark Tower about their pull list membership.
It's good.
It is fantastic. Dark Tower carries a wonderful selection of mainstream comics, independent comics, trade paperbacks, and statues, as well as action figures. Come to Dark Tower for all of your comics and collectibles needs.
It's a lifestyle choice.
Absolutely.
And remember that your Around Comics experience isn't complete until you've checked out this week's Long Box of Love. Each Thursday episode of Around Comics has a wonderfully handcrafted webcomic from Brian Bowles. Check it out every Thursday at www.aroundcomics.com. One more thing I wanted to mention is we're not the only podcasters that are going to be at the New York Comic Con.
Lots
of them. A bunch of people from the Comics Podcast Network.
Yeah.
And they're going to have some special guests, too. I know Jim Starlin is going to be signing at the
Comic News Insider.
And I know Mike Norton will be at CGS, and I think they have some other guests they haven't announced yet, but there's going to be lots of stuff to do.
And actually, Comic News Insider is also doing some benefit work.
Yeah, they're doing a benefit for a literacy charity, mm-hmm. and they're doing raffles. So it's like $1 to buy a ticket, And they have a bunch of stuff to raffle off. I think they're going to be raffling stuff off Friday and Saturday. I don't know about Sunday. But so, yeah, there's going to be like a dozen of us podcasters in there, and come check us all out.
Yeah, come see Comic News Insider, Comic Geek Speak, Meanwhile, the comic book podcast, Andy Spinnerack, Variant Edition, Comics Cast, Raging Bullets, Comic Timing, Pop Cult Online, Bullpen Bulletins.
Our boys from the Bullpen Bulletins.
Yeah, we're sitting right next to him.
Yes,
we are.
I'm sitting right on top of David.
Don't look forward to being between Vince B in the bathroom.
No, we're not. We're Tom. We're on the right side. It's
Women. We're near the women's. Hello, ladies.
Oh, good lord.
They're right by the women's bathroom in the elevator.
Everyone knows
so
you hang out by the women's bathroom.
What are Tom and Carmine Infantino doing by the women's bathroom? What is going on over there?
So we're going to have a huge list of thank yous and all that coming back from New York. So we're really looking forward to it. All right, guys. Today's episode, one that we have all been looking forward to, especially Tom. We are talking with Mr. Mark Guggenheim. Mark Guggenheim is a veteran writer from the world of TV. His credits include stints on The Practice, Law & Order, CSI Miami, and Brothers and Sisters. That's currently. Comic book fans know him as the writer who took Wolverine on his vendetta during Civil War and is currently spinning tales with Howard Chaykin in Blade, as well as the socially relevant action miniseries Hyperion vs. Nighthawk. To the excitement of Tom Caters and others, Mark will be taking over the writing duties of DC's The Flash. Around Comics is happy to welcome Mark Guggenheim. Mark, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule and for talking with us tonight. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you, guys. It's always nice when people are interested in anything I have to say.
Well, I think more importantly, people have become very interested in things that you have to write, especially.
Nice segue.
And that you like that, especially in the world of comics. I'm gonna kind of go back to the first time that I was aware of your work, and that was on Wolverine, and we had. We'd seen two Wolverine series that were slated to come out about the same time, and one was the Dan Way and Steve Dillon Wolverine Origins, and then this guy named Mark Guggenheim was going to be working with Humberto Ramos, and I'm a big Dan Way fan and Steve Dillon also, but I have to tell you, your run on Wolverine really was woke me up to what you're able to do as a writer, so... It's a great series.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate that. You know, that was... I'm still, like... I still look back on that and scratch my head and go, what the hell was Marvel thinking when they put me on the book? Because, I mean, it really was like, who's more Guggenheim? You know, what's he done? Why is he writing Wolverine? Like, shouldn't he be starting off on, you know, some, you know, third-tier character, like Slapstick or something? I owe Axel Alonso a huge debt of gratitude for taking an incredible flyer on me. You know, I wish I could say I like blackmailed him or something, but he just, you know, I don't know, saw something and let me at one of the big toys.
As part of the Civil War storyline, you did a really good job of giving that sort of a portion of the story its own very unique feel to it and had its own importance to it. And I guess I was wondering, what was your experience working on like a huge crossover as being your first thing that you really did for a big company like that?
You know, it was interesting because the first thing is when Axel, you know, offered me the gig, he's like, listen, you know, this is it's a big crossover, so it's high profile and that's wonderful, but at the same time it has all these headaches involved, just the nature of a company-wide crossover. And as a longtime reader, I sort of instinctively understood what he was talking about. But I like my first sort of desire was to address a problem I always have as a reader, which is, you know, you read these tie-ins, and the only thing they have to do with the crossover is the trade dress. So my first, you know, goal was come up with a story that actually would matter, but at the same time they would let me do. And I just, you know, I pitched what came the story, and much to my surprise, Marvel didn't say, oh, we're already doing that in Spider-Man, or we're already doing that in Fantastic Four. They said, yeah, go ahead, go do that.
Was there any sort of trepidation on your part coming into Marvel and your first ongoing series being a character like Wolverine that's obviously hugely popular, you know, and has been around for so long? Did you have any, you know, fear at all jumping in with that character?
Yeah, but because every project I approach with a huge amount of trepidation. every time I face the blank page on any project in any medium, I'm waiting to be found out as a fraud. trepidation has become such a normal part of my work process that I don't even really think about it. But all kidding aside, the most amount of trepidation I felt truly was I didn't want to let Axel down because, like I said, he really took a flyer on really way out on a limb, and more than anything, I just didn't want to betray the trust he was putting in me.
Writing for comics is so different because your name is on a comic and is very much a part of what that comic is. Can you tell us a little bit what the difference is from a fan perspective of writing for TV as opposed to writing for comics?
Yeah. Well, with TV, you really are you're pretty much separated from your fan base. The closest I got to my, not my fans. I mean, that's the other thing. It's like when you're a TV writer, you really don't have your own fans unless you're David Kelly or Aaron Sorkin or someone who is really is an iconic writer. You don't have fans. Your show has fans, if you're lucky. And the extent you have contact with those fans, it's very, very limited. I mean, when I was working on Law and Order, I would participate on the youth group, the Usenet news groups, the message board. But that was pretty much it, and that was pretty isolated. In contrast with comic books, much bigger name recognition. You're sort of one of the draws of the book. And part of the job description to me in this day and age is to be involved with the fan base and be in touch with the fan base and participate on the message boards and interviews and just do a lot more press than you ever get a chance to as a TV writer.
With you, coming into comics, and obviously, you were an experienced writer and a successful one beforehand, but I think a lot of people, we had seen writers from different mediums come into comics, and some were successful, some weren't. I think a lot of people were sort of surprised that you jumped right in, and your work was, extremely good from the get-go, which I don't want to say surprised people, but in some regards, I think it may have. But this isn't like you came into comics without knowing anything about it. I understand you actually interned at Marvel in the 90s?
Yeah, I interned at Marvel between my sophomore and junior years of college in the summertime as part of their summer internship program. It's funny, I always told people before I started working for television that was my favorite job that I've ever had. And it's since, it still looms very large and fondly in my memory, but now I've been even luckier to have worked in television and in comics as a writer. But I still look back on those internship days and, really, really fondly and nostalgically.
When you're talking about writing for television, you've also worked on Blade, which is, recently had a unsuccessful attempt to move into the realm of television. And sort of approaching a character like that that's been in a lot of different hands and it's been on TV and it's been in movies. Do you speak a little bit to like the experience of writing a character that has crossed all those media boundaries?
The Blade series is really that's a labor of love. They're all labors of love because I just love comic books. But with Blade, you're not doing the huge sales, and the name recognition that Wolverine brings you. You're really doing it because you love the character and you love stories with him. But I guess to more fully address your point, Blade's really weird. He's almost unique insofar as he's had a lot more success outside of comics than he has within comics. So he you know, he's sort of, I'm trying to think of any other comic book character that can you can say that about, and I'm really not coming up with anybody.
Howard the Duck.
Yeah.
No, that no, movie was sorry. Horrible.
I don't know if Howard really counts.
Well, do you consider yourself a TV writer that writes comic books, or a comic book writer who writes for TV, or just a writer?
I consider myself just a writer. I really believe that if you're a writer, you write, and you don't necessarily have to pigeonhole yourself in a different in one medium. I mean, that's not to say that some writers don't have trouble adapting from one medium to another, but I kind of, the way I approach things is, I'm a writer, and writers write, and, you know, writers write whatever they can get hired to write, and I've been lucky insofar as I've been hired in four different mediums, but I don't, like, you know, limit myself to thinking myself only as a TV writer, or only as a comic writer, or only as, you know, picked up. To me, it's all writing. It's not to say that my approach is the same to you know, to every medium. It's not. Each medium has its own strengths and weaknesses in terms of what it can accomplish narratively. So I'm always adapting my writing to what I'm working in. But to me, it's like writers write.
Well, speaking about writing to the strengths, could you talk a little bit about the difference between maybe how you approach a TV script and writing to the strengths of the actors or the director that's going to be involved in that project compared to a comic book strip or a comic book script and working with the artists or the characters that are involved on the comic? Are there similarities in how you approach that or are there huge differences?
They're both, honestly. I mean, there are similarities insofar as the process is, in very broad strokes, the same. I'm always thinking about, okay, well, what can be accomplished, you know, what can be accomplished in the comic book versus what can be accomplished in the TV show? You know, when I'm writing a comic book, I'm thinking in the back of my mind, okay, someone's going to have to draw it. So I've got to describe it a certain way. I've got to, you know, if it's an emotional type of scene, if it's not an action scene, I have to write towards the artist's strengths in terms of what they're able to convey on the page. Whereas in television, I'm writing towards or away the actor's strengths and weaknesses. So it's similar in the sense that in both cases, I'm thinking about the capability, the acting capabilities. It's different in the sense that if acting in a comic book comes through a pencil and the acting in TV show comes up through the actor. Another, I think probably like the biggest difference is, and this was sort of like the biggest piece of my conquering the learning curve of moving from TV to comics, is everything's fluid, everything's, you know, hopefully moving, and there's a lot of talk. Television is a dialogue-based medium. It's all about the dialogue. Whereas with comic books, it's a visual medium. It's all about the visuals, and every visual is static. There is no movement. So I had to really train myself to think in terms of, okay, this has to happen in two panels versus one panel. You know, I'm doing this extra math to make sure that not requiring too much happening in a single panel. Similarly, I'm also trying to make sure that there's not too much talk going on. You know, as a TV writer, you're tempted to just make it 22 pages of people talking to each other. That doesn't make for a very good comic book. It doesn't make for an interesting comic book.
Working with a TV script and working in that process, do you ever work with the, like, storyboarders with your script, or is that a completely separate process of that project?
You know, it's really interesting. I've been doing television for 7 years now, and I just started working with a storyboard artist this year on a pilot. It's actually going into production on Tuesday. It's a pretty special effects-heavy pilot. So we actually brought in a storyboard artist to help us with the special effects sequences. And just by pure coincidence, that storyboard artist is Brian Murray, who used to draw Young All-Stars for DC and has done some other comics as well. So By sheer happenstance, got a chance. My storyboard experience was with a former comic book artist.
In regards to working with the strengths of the different artists in comics, how's the process working with Howard Chaykin? I'm a huge fan of Howard Chaykin's, and I was wondering, you know, he has a certain reputation in the industry or with fans. I was just working wondering how that process has been and how that relationship has been with him.
Well, first of all, I'm a huge fan of Howard too. You know, that's why it's actually for me. One of the biggest thrills about working in comic books is to get to work with artists like Paul DeLacy and Howard Chaykin, who have been doing it for so long that I remember growing up with their comics. Like, that is something so cool, I can't even, you know, just fully describe how cool it is to me. But as far as the process with Howard, honestly, it's been a total dream. He has just been so incredibly professional. In fact, I you know, chide him sometimes for being, he's so damn professional that I feel like I'm writing a Blade script every other week because he's just turning around things so fast and it always looks gorgeous and the storytelling's always, and he you know, pulls off every moment in the script exactly the way I saw it in my mind. I mean, it's been so much fun to work with him. Even apart from the, you know, the fanboy, like, thrill of, hey, I'm working with Howard Chaykin, it was also just, like, he's really kicking ass.
Working, you know, Paul Gulacy, Humberto Ramos, Howard Chaykin, what kind of a thrill has it been to have that trio to start with as really kind of your breaking into comics?
I am such a lucky bastard. I don't know what I did right, that's been my biggest break. And it's like every time I get a phone call from an editor and they pitch me an artist, it's like an all-star. And I'm just absolutely floored. And it makes, you know, you asked earlier, like, what's it like to, like, sort of, you know, you break in and you break in sort of immediately with a good reputation. To me, I'm really benefiting hugely from the artist I'm working with. Because you really are, you're only as good as your artist, as a writer of comic books. I mean, you can be Alan Moore, you can be Grant Morrison, but, you know, if you don't have, like, a Dave Gibbons, you know, drawing your stuff, it's like no one's going to notice, and even the story is not going to work as well as you thought it would.
Well, jumping around a little bit, I wanted to ask you more about your early history as far as your writing career and how that got started. I understand you were initially going to be a lawyer. How did you go from that to becoming a TV writer and now a comic book writer?
A lot of luck, first of all. But basically, here's sort of the story. I was in my third year of law school, and my brother, Eric, who's a screenwriter, was in his final year of film school. And really, as a lark more than anything else, we decided to write a script together. And my first time really, you know, writing any sort of script, and my first forays into creative writing. And we wrote a couple of TV sample scripts, and then we wrote a movie together. And I got bit by the writing bug, and it was like, wow, this is a lot of fun. And I ended up, after graduating from law school, I ended up practicing law. And I was dividing my time between practicing law and using every spare hour to write, because I was really enjoying it. And I was, you know, doing it that way for, you know, about, you know, 4 or 5 years. I was in my fifth year of practice when I was starting to feel like I was getting tired of the law. I was also getting tired of trying to bring the candle to the end. I was waking up at like 5 o'clock in the morning to write, because I found I could write more productively in the day, in the morning than I could at the end of the day, after, you know, putting in a 16-hour day of practicing law. I was taking all my vacation time and flying out to LA to take meetings, and in the meantime, my practice was, you know, making me really, really busy. So I was like, you know what, if I'm gonna do this, I gotta, like, do it all the way. I gotta move out to Los Angeles. At the time I was in Boston. And I got to do it before I'm committed to the partnership track. And I got to do it before I'm married with 3 kids and a mortgage. I think I'm sorry to move. So I quit my job, I moved out to L.A., and I knew I wanted to work in television, so I scheduled my move to coincide with staffing season. Staffing season is the period of the year where TV shows start hiring their writing staffs for the upcoming season. And at the time, I already had a manager, and I wrote a sample West Wing script. And my manager read it, and she liked it. She said that she could get me a job with this script, but an agent could get me a better quality job. So she sent it around to a few agencies, and the first agent who read it had just placed a couple people on the practice. And this is actually where luck comes in. David Kelly, who created and was running the practice, was looking to take a step back. He wanted on Boston Public, which was going to launch that year, and he wanted to hire brand-new writers, first-year writers, who were also lawyers. And I had the good fortune to be a brand-new writer who was also a lawyer and a lawyer in Boston, which was where the show was set. So it was like a dream opportunity, and it couldn't have come along at a better time. So it was totally right place, right time. And then once I was doing that, I just kept working.
Hey, you know, speaking of David Kelly shows, I've enjoyed just about everything that he's done, especially, you know, Boston Public, Boston Legal, and
he's a huge Ally McBeal fan.
No, well, but I was wondering if you could give us any insight as to why it seemed David Kelly shows kept getting, like, the runaround by networks. It would be a successful show, and then they would move it to a different time slot, and it would be less successful. Any insight on that?
Which David Kelly show do you feel got moved around?
Well, I thought The Practice did. I thought Boston Public did. Right when at that show, I thought seemed to really
start to get its feet.
Then they moved it around, and then Boston Legal, I thought they did in the beginning, but that didn't seem to hurt the momentum on that show as much.
It's funny. Those are three different shows, and actually two different networks in the case of The Practice and Boston Legal versus Boston Public. And there's three different explanations. I could go into all three, but I'm afraid that would be boring. Let me just quickly give you The Practice, because I know you're the best. The Practice was ordered as a mid-season show. They ordered 13 episodes, and that's common for a mid-season. Basically, ABC didn't have a schedule, but a network orders a mid-season show. They're basically ordering insurance that their fall shows, in case their fall shows don't do well, they have a mid-season show to put it in place. Well, the year The Practice premiered, ABC had the good fortune of having a fairly good development season, so their shows were all doing pretty well. So what happened was, rather than bump an entire season of The Practice for the next year, they put NYPD Blue off the air for six and ran six episodes of The Practice in its place. So the first time slot, The Practice, was always a temporary, they were just renting the space, they weren't owning it. Then in its second year, they were on Saturdays. They didn't get moved around in its second year. I don't think they moved to... Oh, you know what? I'm sorry. You're right. They were on Monday nights for a portion of their second year, and then on Saturday nights for a portion of the second half of the second year. So they got moved around a little bit there. But that was happening because The Practice wasn't doing that well ratings-wise, so they were trying it out in different time slots. And then when it landed on Sunday night, it started pulling in really nice numbers, particularly when it was airing after Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and it stayed there, I want to say, pretty much for the entirety of its run. Is that completely boring, guys?
No, it's interesting. I mean, from purely a fan perspective of it, you just sort of wonder sometimes. You get hooked into a show, and then all of a sudden it gets moved, and you either don't realize it, or you've lost, you're behind a few episodes before.
And it's got to be frustrating as a creator or a cast member of a show to achieve a certain level of success, and then have a show moved around multiple times.
It's really terrifying. It's a big it's a big thing, you know. Like this year, I think the big success story that the media hasn't covered nearly enough is Grey's Anatomy. They took a hit show, and its youth, almost its infancy, moved it to a very time slot, you know, Thursday, and at 9, and it's done incredibly well. That was a huge risk because they were doing great on, you know, Sunday nights at 10.
Hello, this is Steve Niles, and you are listening to Around Comics.
The big news, especially for Tom here, is that you're taking on a book over at DC, and that, of course, is The Flash. I've read that you are a longtime fan of that character. What is it like taking on an iconic character like The Flash?
Well, you really do sort of get into the whole terrifying thing we were talking about earlier. But even more so, it's funny. In a way, I feel more pressure with The Flash than I did with Wolverine. I'm not entirely sure why that is. I think in large part because the fan base for Flash is far more passionate and vocal than the fan base for Wolverine. It's the first character I've taken on where I really feel like, wow, people are really watching this incredibly closely. You know, with Wolverine, there are so many Wolverine books, and there have been so many Wolverine books, and in a way, I almost feel like I can't ruin him. Like, you can't ruin Wolverine, because the worst that happens is that I have a bad arc, and people move on. But now I'm, like, taking on a book. It's an open-ended commitment. There's no Flash origin series. Like, I don't have Daniel Way backstopping me. If I screw up the Flash, people can't pick up, you know, Brian Vaughn's Flash series the same month. Their Flash fixed that way. I'm the guy. So there's a lot of pressure there.
I also think it's interesting because the history of the Flash is sort of defined by the fact that people who have written it for a really long time. There aren't too many people who have had their 5-issue shots at the Flash. You know, you have people like Kerry Bates and William Messner-Loebs and Wade and Johns and all of them. Is that in any way intimidating to go into a book knowing that so many people have sort of had their big stamp on what the book is?
You know, it's funny. I'm really old school in the sense that I like writers who make long runs on a book. As a reader, I'm not a big fan of the 5 issues, get in, get out. So I decided when I broke in that it was within my control. To the extent I could make an open-ended commitment, I would, and I would stay on a book as long as I possibly could. That's actually the commitment I made to Blade. And it's also the commitment I made to The Flash. And you're right, you know, the truth is, it's not, you know, when I think of Mike Barron or William Messner-Loebs or Jeff Johns or Mark Waid, I don't get intimidated from the length of their runs. I get intimidated from the quality of their runs.
Yeah.
but holy, they're so good that I worry about, you know, I worry about matching, you know, 5 issues of Mark Waid, much less, you know, his entire run.
Well, on the other spectrum, on the other end of that spectrum, you're picking up after a short run by Bilson and DeMeo that was not looked at favorably by a lot of the fans. Is there any, you know, concern in that regards? Is coming into a series after you know, after a start by another team that wasn't well received?
You know, it's funny. I kind of feel like, you know, and I say this really to be humorous, not to characterize fandom this way, but it's like being the second cop through the door. You know, you feel bad for that first guy, or like, you know, the first guy off the beach, you know, on the beach in Normandy. The thing is that, you know, every time you have a character change within an iconic character, you know, Wally taking over for Barry, Mark taking over for Wally, Kyle Rayner taking over for Hal, Jordan, when we're talking about Green Lantern, there's resistance. And Bilson DeMeo had the unfortunate task of being the first guys in the door when it came to establishing Wally. Do I feel trepidant? My attitude is, I remember when when Wally took over for Barry, and I remember, there wasn't an internet back then, but I remember just reading magazines, and even through the magazines, you could feel the resistance to it. And now, Wally's, considered every bit the Flash that Barry was. My goal is to make people feel the same way about Bart.
One of the things that interests me most about picking up the Flash where you are is that it is true that people were very resistant to Wally taking over the Flash, but people wrote it in such a way that the character became its own distinct entity away from Barry, and he became his own character, and he became the Flash. What sort of approach have you taken to taking Bart's character and making him his own person? Is it going back to the Impulse roots, or is it taking a new angle on what the character is like?
I guess sort of, it's funny. I always start from, I just want to tell a really good story. And I want to tell good stories with that character as close to the essence of that character as I can. So with the thing that I've really tried to focus on, and just based upon the phone conversations I've had with a few people this week, I apparently have done an okay job with, is getting Bart, to act in that sort of witty way that we sort of associate with Impulse without taking him back a few steps maturity-wise. I feel like Jeff Johns in his Teen Titans run did a really nice job of giving Bart a certain maturity, a certain swing up, and I wanted one of my main goals with the character with my first few issues is establish him just as mature and just as experienced, because I didn't want to undo the stuff that Jeff did, but at the same time, give him that twinkle in his eye, that smile behind every line of dialogue, so that we still felt like, oh yeah, it's the Bart we know from Impulse. He's just grown up a little bit.
Oh, I want to go back to something you had said a few moments ago, and that was that as kind of an old school comic fan who really enjoys the, I guess we call them one and done stories now, I'm really enjoying your run on Blade. And one of the real reasons that I enjoy that is that each book is self-contained in its story, but you're still leaving a lot of nuggets there that are being carried over, across issues. And it's something I think in today's comics that a lot of people are afraid to jump into a series, but that one in particular, along with Jonah Hex or like Detective Comics, it's nice that you can just jump in at any given issue. And I really enjoy that.
I had originally pitched the idea of doing things as self-contained stories, but giving an overarching mythology. And I did it partially because I thought I want to do everything I possibly can to make Blade accessible to people, because, just from looking at his track record in comic books, he's a hard sell. So I wanted to make it as painless as possible for people to pick up, issues two and on. But at the same time, I wanted to sort of satisfy that nostalgic heat on my part, and I think that need is shared by other readers as well, for those done-in-one self-contained stories where you can just pick up a book and say, okay, I got a story with a beginning, middle, and end there.
Well, I think it's interesting because from the solicits I've seen for the Flash issues, it seems that your first couple issues also sort of take that approach that it's sort of one and done setting things up. Was that a conscious choice to go into the Flash and sort of set up what you're going to do, or was it just how things, worked out?
No, it was extremely conscious because I really want to bring people into the book. And I think that starting off any run or any series with issues that are accessible, that if someone didn't read issue one, they're not completely lost. It's funny. I think I kind of learned that from television, because in television, if you you know, you do a pilot, and then if you get picked up the series, you know, you do the second episode, and in a perfect world, that second episode, I've learned, is it operates as like a second pilot, because the hope is, you know, if you didn't get viewers in on the first episode, they hear a good positive word of mouth, and you can pull them in on the second episode. So that second episode has to be as new user friendly, if you will, as the very first. So I guess you could say I'm sort of taking a lesson I've learned in television, and I'm trying to apply it to comics.
Well, as someone who's obviously, you know, has a foot in both the comic world and Hollywood and television, what's your perspective on how Hollywood looks at the comic industry now as opposed to maybe 10, 15 years ago?
I think Hollywood now, because of the success of Spider-Man, I guess predominantly, Hollywood seems to be viewing comic books as almost a research and development lab or a development process where they're using comic books as a place to get source material for movies and television shows. I mean, gosh, I think right now the big perk of doing anything creator-owned is you stand a really good chance of at the very least getting your creator-owned series options. Options are getting made up all around Hollywood now based on comic book properties. Sometimes even before the comic property is published. So that's, you know, I think it's a big sea change from 15, 20 years ago. I mean, 20 years ago, you're talking about, you know, around the time the Batman movie came out, the first Batman movie, and there, I just remember, you know, just being relieved that the Tim Burton Batman wasn't going to be just a redux of the Adam West Batman.
Cesar Romero with the makeup over his mustache.
But the part is taking, you know, how is Hollywood taking comic books seriously over 20 years?
It's interesting that you say that because I think a lot of fans sort of feel the same way. It's like we've had this appreciation for comics for so long, and we always have this fear that whenever a movie is going to be made or a TV show based on a comic, that it's going to be really horrible.
Catwoman.
And then it just, you know, everyone will look at that as that's what comic books are.
That fear is remarkably well earned.
Well, I think it's interesting because you bring up the fact that a lot of it's banked off of Spider-Man. For a really long time, I've always thought that Spider-Man as a movie worked because Spider-Man as a character is something that people were aware of, and not necessarily that the pure idea of a movie about Spider-Man is something that every person would want to go see.
Yeah.
And it's always sort of conflicted me about the whole comic books as movies, is how much of it is the fact that some of these characters, like Superman and Spider-Man, are just characters that people know, and that's why they go see it, as opposed to the fact that there was never a Spider-Man comic book and a Spider-Man movie came out, would $250 million worth of people go see Spider-Man.
Look at Heroes, though. You got 15 million people a week watching that show, and it's not based on anything.
But would they pay $8 to watch?
Well, I don't know.
Why don't we ask Mark? Mark, what are your thoughts on that?
A lot of my friends work on Heroes. What are my thoughts on why like Spider-Man the movie is more popular than Spider-Man the comic?
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
I guess, I think the answer is movies in general are a more popular medium. Features are huge. They draw a big, big, big audience, bigger than movies, you know, bigger than regular books. Why have more people? I mean, look at the Da Vinci Code. The Da Vinci Code is remarkably popular. That's a phenomenon novel. But I'm willing to bet that more people saw the movie, which wasn't even reviewed that well, than read the novel. So I don't think it's a phenomenon that is even limited to comic books. I think it just says more about the power of the movie than it does about the weakness of comics.
But I also think there's a weird thing in it, too, of the Da Vinci Code. It's not like people are adapting novels just because the Da Vinci Code was successful, you know, as opposed to Spider-Man has this sort of unique sense to it of how all of these sort of movies that have come after Spider-Man, I think, are based pretty heavily on the success that Spider-Man had. And I guess I don't really have a question, and I just said that out loud without having a thought. You know, there's a weird thing in there that's not – there's a little difference between those that I think is really interesting. I can't quite separate all of it out.
I think you're definitely right. I would, you know, not to be contrarian or anything, just as, you know, for the sake of the discussion, I'd point out that there's another component, there's another explanation that I think exists side by side with the Spider-Man for why we're seeing so many comic books turn into movies, and that's because the technology has made them possible.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I mean, Spider-Man, like, you could have done Spider-Man 20 years ago, it probably would have looked really, really lame.
I like a guy shooting a rope out of his wrist.
I think they did make that. Yeah. Well, Mark, you know, one of the things we always talk about on our show is trying to explain to people that comics are a medium and not a genre. What is the attitude in Hollywood about comics? Do you know, as we talk about more and more options being given and that kind of stuff, is there a perception there that comics are just a good breeding ground for good stories, regardless of superhero or not?
And yes, we do expect you to answer for all of Hollywood.
Yes, for all of Hollywood. You are their mouthpiece.
That's a lot of people. You know, honestly, I think that they do view it as a breeding ground for stories of all kinds. You know, the process of working up a idea for a TV show or a movie is called the development process. And I think they now view comic books as part of the development process. It's a tool to find just new stories to tell, not just comic books. I mean, when I say that a lot of comics, creator-owned stuff, is being optioned these days, I'm thinking of a lot of comics that are not superhero comics at all. Or to the extent they are superhero comics, they're not straight superhero comics. They're not like, you know, straight ahead, you know, Superman or Spider-Man or Batman. There's a real, you know, comic books do a lot of different genres well. I think they do superheroes perhaps the best, but they do crime, they do science, you know, hard science fiction, they do horror. There's all sorts of genres that comic books really do well. And, like, look at Sin City. Yeah, I think that's a really great example of a non-superhero comic that made for a great non-superhero comic and a great non-superhero movie.
Going back to, you were talking about how you moved to L.A. and that's really when your writing career took off. How important was that decision in your career to move out to L.A.?
Huge. Because basically, I wouldn't say that you can't break into Hollywood from outside of Hollywood, but it's extraordinarily hard, and it's already hard to break into Hollywood. Sure. You know, the advice I give to people is, you know, breaking into Hollywood is hard. Why make it all that much harder by not being in Hollywood? So it was pretty critical to me. Also, you know, I got my job on the after moving out to L.A., and people always say to me, oh, my God, you know, that's so fast. And I always point out to them that I had been writing for 5 years before moving out to L.A., and I was writing for 5 years 3,000 miles away. 2 months after I moved to L.A., I get a job. I think that pretty much says it all about how important it is to be in the area.
And the law school didn't hurt either.
Law school didn't hurt. Actually, just totally coincidentally, it didn't at all help me get the job. But I graduated from the same law school as David Kelly.
Oh, there you go.
Nice.
Alum.
Well, speaking of lawyers and bringing it back to comics, there's a pretty good writer doing Daredevil right now, and I think that Ed Brubaker is planning on staying with it for a while. But would writing a superhero who is also a lawyer ever appeal to you?
I've made two things really clear, that were Ed to get hit by a bus and be unable to write Daredevil, I would love that. I've also made it clear that I know how to drive a bus.
Watch out, Ed. Oh, he's gunning for you.
I'm sort of, this is more about sort of the comics end of it, is you're taking over a character like The Flash, you've written something like Blade, you're obviously a fan. How much of, when you enter into writing a character with a history, how much of it is balancing that sort of desire I think a lot of fans have, especially Flash fans, of being, they want a balance of new twists on the story, but they want to see the old. You know, how, as a writer...
How well do you know Gorilla Grodd?
I mean, like, how, as approaching writing a comic book, do you go in saying, I got to give them a little bit of this, but I have to give them a little bit of that? Is there a balance there? Is there something you don't even think about?
You know, it's funny. I've actually been thinking about this a lot lately, you know, both as a writer and as a fan. And, you know, I think we're in an interesting place because both Marvel and DC have now been around so long, and they've all, like, both companies have had retcons and crises and secret wars and you name it. And it's just made it really hard for writers to come on board a book and have the type of encyclopedic knowledge that used to be possible 20 years ago or even 10 years ago. So there's a certain limitation, natural limitation, what you can reasonably do as a writer to know all the ins and outs. At the same time, you have the internet, which is a fantastic resource, but there's a lot of complex history. Like, you know, coming on Blade, you know, I was simply bowled over by the gaps in his history and the inconsistencies in his history and how what I was reading on the internet wasn't jiving with what I was reading in the comics, and it just felt like a mess, and I was like, I don't even know where to begin. So I think my bottom line answer to your question is, I think it's all it comes down to respect. I think what fans should look for from their writers is that the writers will approach the characters with respect. And part of that respect is doing your homework, doing your due diligence, but at the same time knowing that no amount of due diligence is going to give you that encyclopedic knowledge that maybe some fans are expecting. And also that the continuity cart shouldn't drag the good story horse. You know, you gotta find that right. And like I said, it comes down to respect. Like, if you're just respectful to the character and you're respectful to the history and you're respectful to the fans, I think that that's like a happy compromise between, you know, the what can be achieved via story and via the complex histories and whatnot. Just be respectful.
Hi, this is Greg Rucka, and we're all around comics.
Let's talk a little bit about another book that you're working on, Hyperion versus Nighthawk, the miniseries. And I just finished reading the second issue of that, and I've really enjoyed what you've done with that so far. I was wondering, you sort of set up the story where it's told from both perspectives of the main characters, and each one of those perspectives sort of also reflects a situation that you have as the backdrop, a bigger real-world, real-life situation. I was wondering if you did that intentionally to try to educate people as well as entertain with the book?
Well, you know, I really think that, you know, anything can work on a couple different levels. Whenever I work in TV or, you know, comic books or whatever, the first goal is to entertain. Am I trying to educate? I guess, you know, I love to write issue-oriented material. In TV and comics, I love to sort of put issues on the table and sort of dissect them. My goal isn't so much to me, I sort of freeze up at the word educate because it sounds like I sort of have an agenda and I'm trying to put forth a certain view. Whereas with issue-oriented stuff, I really am just trying to sort of
enlighten is maybe a better word,
I think raise consciousness.
You did that for me. I'm kind of your stereotypical have my, you know, head in a pile of comic books fan and
rotting
and
paper.
Yeah, you know, I work and I read comics and I try and stay as aware of the world
that
as I can.
That sounds so fucking sad.
Yeah, you know,
loser.
I'm married. I have a life, but you know, I was not as aware of what's going on in Darfur as I should be, as a conscious citizen, and your comic actually educated me a lot about what is going on there, and it was it's very sad, but you know that a comic could educate me to that, you know, spoke a lot. So
because he's really really dense.
Yeah, because I'm very dense. Yeah. Absolutely.
Sort of along those lines, I hate to be the one to tell you this, but like we've been in Iraq for a while.
Yeah. Are you aware of 9/11?
Is that going to be your Flash story?
No, Flash is like very, very non-political. So with Squadron, with Hyperion and Nighthawk, the history of the Squadron Supreme in comics, and especially the way JMS has been approaching it, it makes those characters particularly perfect for doing a real world or a real issue type of story. You know, it just wouldn't work in the Flash. You know, the Flash is a different, you know, that character and what feels right for that, the type of story to tell in that type of book. It's just, you know, it's just different.
Well,
you know,
those characters
are... cosmic treadmill. He's got a cosmic treadmill. You know, you can solve any problem with that.
Those Hyperion and Nighthawk are probably pretty interesting characters to write because they're based on Superman and Batman. But whenever you're writing them, do you approach them as Superman and Batman or as Hyperion and Nighthawk?
I approach them as Hyperion and Nighthawk because, to me, in terms of the costume and the powers, the trappings of the characters are based on Superman and Batman. But the truth is, I'm actually not even writing Hyperion and Nighthawk. I'm writing Mark Milton and Kyle Richmond.
Okay, sure.
You know, to me, it's the guy in the costume that is the most compelling to write. And, you know... even though you'd say, yeah, Hyperion is very similar to Superman and Nighthawk is very similar to Batman, and I would agree with you, I don't think anybody would think that Mark Milton was similar to Superman or that Kyle Richmond was similar to Batman.
No, they're kind of like, you know, alternate reality, like the, you know what, the CSA, the crime syndicate almost, and kind of a what if.
And they're really very, very different, and like... So to me, that's the way I've been approaching it. You know, it would be fun to sort of try to do that whole Darfur storyline with Superman and Batman. I think it would be very interesting. I think it would all come out very differently.
Well, you know, one of the things that I sort of noticed about a lot of the stuff that you've done so far in comics is almost like you approach some of these stories as a way to solve a problem. And I mean that in, like, you know, you jump into Wolverine, and it's a Civil War crossover. It's a huge character, a huge event, and you have to figure out some way to tell a compelling story while at the same time serve, you know, Civil War. And you seem to really be able to figure that out. You were able to solve that equation in an interesting way, and something that I don't think a lot of writers maybe would have come to. I see, you know, the same thing with, you know, like the Blade character and what you've done with that, with, you know, the crossover with Wolverine, which could have been...
really bad.
Yeah, it could have been really bad. And it was probably my favorite Wolverine crossover that I've ever read because of the way you told that story. Do you sort of, I mean, is it accurate to say that you sort of approach storytelling as solving a problem or solving a situation?
Well, two things. First of all, thanks a lot very, very sincerely for the kind words. I mean, I really, really, I'm incredibly flattered and I really appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome.
And yeah, you guys are actually, it's an incredibly astute question because you're 100% right. I do approach things from a problem to solve or a question to answer kind of perspective, because it's funny, I'm not fully conscious of why I do things that way, but yes, I mean, when I read the first issue of Civil War, you know, the script for it, you know, Marvel sent that to me when I agreed to do the Wolverine, that, you know, when I said yes to the gig. And my first reaction was, oh my God, this is amazing. But my second reaction was, well, who's going to go after Nitro? And in asking myself that question, I realized I had to make things of a story. I definitely generate a lot of story ideas simply by either identifying a problem or asking myself a question, and trying to figure out the answer to it. I think that's one of the things that's nice about working in comics is comics have such a deep history. You know, each character for the most part has really deep histories. So there are a lot of those questions that you can try to answer, and that creates a story for you.
I think we've had most of our questions, but we do have some questions from our listeners. Be ready to field a few of those?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, this one comes from L. Dave, our buddy from the near suburbs of Chicago. He says, "Hey, Mark, how in the world do you go from writing characters like Wolverine to Nighthawk and Blade to Bart Allen?"
That's a good question. You know, it's funny. I'm almost reminded of I worked with Greg Berlanti on this pilot of the TV show Brothers and Sisters, and I was working on an issue of Superman and Batman, you know, one day, and he's like, "How do you go from writing dialogue for Sally Field to writing for Superman?" So that's a question from L. Dave. Almost, you know, sort of reminds me of that little comment. You know, I guess the honest answer is I don't really know. But the one thing I can tell you is that I think of all the characters I've written thus far, perhaps Mark is the closest to my own personal voice.
Okay.
And so, in many ways, the challenge hasn't been so much to go from Wolverine to Bart as it is to simply go from myself to Wolverine.
The next question is from Daryl, who says, "I enjoyed your Civil War Wolverine run, and I wanted to know what to look forward to most on your Flash book."
Ooh, I want to come up with a really, like, teasing answer. Look forward to.
The cover with all the rogues on it made me have an almost embarrassing nerdgasm about it.
You have no idea how much Tom has been controlling himself through this entire interview.
That inspires me to give the following answer. My goal here with my first arc is to write a Flash story that will be collected in a trade paperback that people will read for years and years to come. Like, that's the bar I've set for myself.
Nice.
All right.
That's a good answer. You did well.
You're going to go far,
young
man.
You're going to go far. You should write comics.
Thanks. Inspiration for that one.
We like to help out if there's isn't an immediate answer. We like to throw something out there.
This one is from Chris Chavez, and he said, "Hi, Mark. Loved your work on Wolverine, and I'm really looking forward to your run on Flash. Does the perception of a character, in this case, the largely negative feelings towards the initial Flash run, affect how you approach building..." Well, we kind of already covered that. Yeah. How you approach building your mythos of the same character. You know, we already kind of went over that. Let's skip to the next part of his question was, what type of working relationship do you prefer to have with the illustrators of your books? Do you prefer
multiple choice.
A or B.
Do you prefer to take the lead or to work more collaboratively with the artists?
I always prefer collaboration. I've been very lucky with my choice of artists, not that it's ever been my choice, but the artists that I've gotten, like we said earlier. But I haven't always been that lucky to know who my artist is at the start of a project. You know, with Wolverine, I knew it would be Humberto. You know, when I started writing Hyperion and Nighthawk, I didn't know it was going to be Paul. So sometimes I know who the artist is, but a lot of times I feel like I haven't known, at least as I'm writing the first issue. So my preference is to be totally collaborative. I just haven't always had the good fortune to be able to do that, at least at the very start.
Well, how would you go about telling someone like Howard Chaykin, you know, Howard, I really don't like this panel. Can we rework that?
You know, it's funny. First of all, Howard's never drawn a panel I haven't liked. in a couple of cases, you know, I'll say, hey, you know, this panel isn't quite what I'd envisioned, and here's why here's what I was thinking, and we just talk it out, you know? The great thing about working with someone like Howard is he's been doing this for so long. He understands comics and comic storytelling on a level that is so much more nuanced and expert than my understanding. It's very hard to argue with someone who's got that kind of experience.
Next question is from David Price, and I'm going to skip to the part that I'm most interested in. You had mentioned in comic book resources you started reading The Flash sort of with the trial of Barry Allen, and he would like to know that, you knowing the law, would you have done anything different in his defense? Did you agree with the acquittal? And I would like to mention that they don't teach you in law school how to handle what happens when your client gets a facelift from intelligent gorillas. So don't expect an answer from that.
That's a very good question. I will say that. How about? Can I answer it with a correction of the question?
Yes.
I actually had started reading it before the trial of Barry Allen. The first few issues in, I think I was reading it regularly, month to month, starting with the trial. I can't really speak to the whole defensive barrier.
It was a kangaroo.
So he was guilty.
He was guilty. Well, it's a kangaroo court. I mean, he didn't stand a chance. That damn abracadabra. We have a question from Lee Webb, who is from Australia. And so we're asking this very specifically because he has an Australia-based question. Captain Boomerang is pretty much the longest-running Australian character in comics. Since Identity Crisis, this has changed to an illegitimate American kid. Is there a Smurfs chance in hell that a Captain Boomerang character could be an Australian, or at least have another decent Australian introduced into the DC universe? And we are huge in Australia.
Yes, Australia, yeah. They scream for you to give them someone
your
to
root answer
for.
Could affect your creator own work as well.
Just keep that in mind.
I got two words for you. Admiral Boomerang.
I will accept that as an answer. Finally, a promotion.
You heard it here first, Lee Webb.
Admiral Boomerang.
Admiral Boomerang.
All right, and I think Talkback and Chip had some questions, but I think that we had already covered them. Guys, do you have anything left for Mark?
Well, Mark, you're working on Wolverine, working on The Flash, Hyperion versus Nighthawk, Blade, but you're also working on a creator original owned creator series coming out of Oni called Resurrection. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, good question. Resurrection is I'm not what I consider to be a high concept writer. My ideas are not the type of ideas that are easily synopsized in one sentence log line. So I don't ever come up with any big ideas. Resurrection is one of the very few big ideas that I've ever had, and it's simple. We've seen movies like The Day of the Earth Stood Still, or War of the Worlds, or Independence Day, or pick a alien invasion movie, and I've always wondered, okay, that's all well and good, and we get rid of the aliens, but now what? And the whole logline, the whole premise of Resurrection comes down to now what? It picks up, the first issue is actually entitled The Day After, and it picks up the day after the aliens have left the planet, they've been turned back, and now what? And the idea is to sort of explore it in as realistic and dramatic and compelling a way, while at the same time teasing how the heck did we drive the aliens off the planet anyway? And that'll make up part of the mythology of the show, of the series. We'll wonder, we'll slowly find out, peel back the onion on how exactly we pulled this off. So it's really almost sort of two stories in one. You get the day after, the aftermath of the alien invasion, but you also get the alien invasion too. We're just going to tell it in an unexpected way.
And is that going to be a graphic novel, or is that going to be an ongoing series, or how is that coming out?
It's going to be an ongoing series. We have an artist who's actually already started. I'm not at liberty to say his name yet, but it's going to be ongoing, and honestly, the burden is on me to bank enough scripts to solicit it. But it is coming, and I'm really proud of it. I'm like I said, I don't have too many of these high-concept kind of ideas, but this is one of them. It's one I've had for a long, long time, and it's very near and dear to my heart. I'm really looking forward to to seeing that whole book come to life.
It's nice that you don't have an iconic character or a series that, continuity to
only
build on.
Humanity, Chris. The history of man.
For one thing, it's not a superhero book.
Sure.
So it's different in that regard too.
What?
It's very, very different from the comic book work I've done thus far in just about every respect.
Are you and your brother Eric, are you big hockey fans since he wrote Miracle?
He's a huge hockey fan, and thank you for noticing that he wrote Miracle. He's a totally huge hockey fan. I'm not so much. he's just the biggest hockey fan. He knows so much about that sport.
Oh, it's a great movie. He wrote a great screenplay.
Yeah, no kidding.
Thank you. I think so, too. I think it really rocks.
One other question I did have for you. I had read something about a pilot that you had written or co-written.
Oh, Eli.
That's coming, Eli Stone. That's coming out soon, or is in development?
We start filming on Tuesday, actually.
Oh wow! Congratulations.
Thank you. We're really excited. We got the pickup. Maybe I should quickly explain sort of how these things work. You pitch a show. If they like the pitch, they buy the script. If they like the script, they produce the pilot. If they like the pilot, they put it on the air. We wrote this script on spec, meaning we didn't pitch it. We just wrote it. So we skipped that first step, and we turned it in at the end of July. I was actually at Comic-Con when the script went over to the network. It got picked up in August. We've actually been in pre-production since August, so it's really kind of a thrill to finally be filming it starting on Tuesday.
Nice.
Well, tell us a little bit about it. What's the concept behind it?
It's about a lawyer who may or may not be a modern-day prophet. And the reason I say he may or may not be is he has these prophetic visions, but he also finds out in the pilot that he has a brain aneurysm. So it's really left to the audience to determine if he's a prophet or he's just suffering from this condition. And it's a real new take on the concept of a legal drama. It's got equal parts character show and equal parts legal procedural. With this sort of spiritual question at the center of it.
And that's going to be on ABC. Do you know as far as like when that will be out or when we'll be able to watch it?
God willing, you'll see it in the fall. Like I said, you were one of, I think 13 pilots that ABC has ordered. They'll pick up next pilots in May. Just in by way of background, every year, I pick a number, 50 pilots are made by all the networks, and you maybe only, 10, 15 of those 50 actually make it to air. So, I always joke that, Eli will either be seen by millions of people or as many people as I can fit in my living room.
I was wondering, a lot of times when we talk to comic book writers, they don't pay attention that much to other comic books. Do you pay attention to other TV shows? Do you watch a lot of TV? Or do you kind of, keep your head in the sand on that?
Oh, no. I watch as much TV as I can, given my workload and the fact that I'm married with a 2-year-old. But I love television, and I watch, literally as much of it as I can. There's a lot of shows that I really enjoy, and my TiVo is filled up.
Do you happen to be watching Studio 60? And if so, what are your feelings on it, considering it's sort of a show about TV writers?
I love Studio 60. I mean, I have to confess straight up, I just worship at the altar of Aaron Sorkin and his writing. Anything he writes, I'm going to watch religiously. I never miss Studio 60.
Yeah, I love that show, too, and I hope it sticks around for a while. I know that it's had some issues, but I don't know. But I think it's a
TV
fantastic
cast.
So your husband, father, comic book writer, TV writer, I guess the probably how we should wrap up is how do you keep it all balanced? Because you've got a lot on your plate.
Yeah, I have no idea. I suspect if you were to call up any one of my editors today, they would say, he's not doing a very good job of it.
It's the trepidation. That's the trepidation speaking.
It really is. It's the fact that this has been a particularly crazy week leading up to production of the pilot. But, I have a really wonderful, understanding wife. I have to say, this is where the legal background, where you're juggling, 5-10 cases at a time, really comes into play, because I learned under very heavy fire how to manage my time.
I'm an accountant, so I understand.
Yeah, Tom is an accountant during tax season right now, so he's right with you.
Exactly. That's the best example, actually, accountants during tax season.
Well, one of the big things about comic books and the comic book industry is convention season, and I would assume that with your other career that's very demanding and your family life, what is your convention schedule going to look like for the next year?
That's a good question. I'm definitely going to go to Wizard World because it's 20 minutes from my house.
Okay.
And I'm planning on going to San Diego Comic Con. Mm-hmm. And did my wife and my daughter come down with me? Though my wife has been telling me I'll stay in a nice hotel in San Diego and I'll stay by the pool, but there's no way I'm going to Comic-Con again this year. We went last year and we were actually, my wife was pushing our daughter in the stroller, and because it's Comic-Con and, the tide of people can literally sweep you away, and I got separated from them, I fought my way back through the throng of people, and I looked at my wife, and the expression on her face said it all to me, and I said to her, "You're not coming back with me next year, are you?"
Well, was that tidal wave of people stormtroopers?
There were some stormtroopers. I think they were Elvis stormtroopers.
Oh, nice. The best kind.
Well,
it is
Chicago is very nice in August. If you're interested in coming to our convention here, we'd love to have you.
I would love to. I mean, I love conventions, and I would go to all of them if I possibly could.
Sure.
If I can make it to Chicago, I would love to come.
All right.
I'm all good.
Well, Mark, we want to thank you so much. Are you still stranded in traffic?
No, actually, I'm sitting outside my house as we speak.
Oh.
What a great way to spend the commute. This was a lot of fun for me, guys. I'm really flattered, and I really enjoyed myself.
Well, we're honored to have you, and I think I speak for Tom and Sal. Anytime you would like to be back on, just drop us a line. It was a pleasure talking with you.
And thanks so much for taking time, especially during this week where you're leading up to filming your show. I mean, I'm sure you're extremely busy, so we really appreciate you taking the time with us.
Oh, totally my pleasure. This really was a lot of fun, seriously. Okay.
Well, we love the work, and Tom is ready for the Flash. He's got his fingers crossed.
I can't wait to make the Flash my top of the stack for the week, and I'm looking forward to it, so it'll be fun.
In all honesty, when it was announced that you were taking over the Flash, it was, I think, around December, and Tom considered it an early Christmas gift for him. So,
yeah, because I enjoyed your Wolverine so much. I was like, oh, wow.
Yes,
I approved. You're in the Flash.
Yeah, I'm like, that's Tom great. Approved right away.
Tom Brevoort, one of my Marvel editors, is a huge, huge, huge Flash fan. And I just feel like, so this is great. If I blow this, I not only blow the Flash gig, but probably future Marvel work as well.
Oh, yeah. You have that weird dichotomy right there.
No pressure.
Yeah. But no, it was great.
You know, that brought up one other question, just a, kind of a silly one.
We're never going to let him.
Sorry, I'm sorry. Getting any dirty looks when you, you know, hang over at the Marvel booth and now that you're working for DC, they giving you a hard time at all about that?
They give me a hard time. A little bit, but not, it's all good nature. It really is. You know, they joke about it.
Sure.
There's a lot of humor. You know, it's all very, very good natured. Hey, they haven't signed me to an exclusive, so they could hardly blame me for doing work on the other side of the street.
That's right.
Hear that, Marvel? All right. Well, Mark, you
let
have...
Let him write the Flash for a really long time.
Mark, you have a wonderful night, right. And thank you again so much.
My pleasure. Have a really great weekend, guys.
All right, you too. We'll
thank you,
to
Mark.
Take care. Bye.
All right, bye-bye. And we would certainly like to thank Mr. Guggenheim for spending some time with us today.
His Flash sounds interesting. His creator-owned stuff from Oni also sounds incredibly interesting.
His TV pilot, I hope that makes it to air, because I'd be really interested to see that and go, I know that guy. Well, yeah, I talked to that guy once. I
think he was in his car.
Yeah.
I think he is really one of the up-and-coming names in comics. So
that's cool.
It's going to be interesting to see where he goes in the next couple of years.
As far as like a prototype, you know, to follow... For a guy coming from a different medium to write comics, I don't know that many people have done it better than he has to just jump in and really get it and do a good job.
He's
a big fan.
I think it's grow up as a huge comic book fan, go to law school, but be a writer and then move to LA, write for TV for 7 years, then write comics.
Exactly. That old cliche.
That works.
Yeah. It always happens.
But it works. Don't fix it if it ain't broke. That's what I say.
Are you other lawyers out there? Lawyers listen to this show. Homeless people listen to this show.
Oh, and if Ed Brubaker gets run over by a bus,
we know who
did it. We know who did it.
I almost had to stop the interview at that point. You know, I can't have him, you know, harshing on my Brubaker.
On your brew?
Come on, man.
He likes it so much that the only way it could end is by him.
I want to, you know what? We didn't ask him about, but I wanted to ask him about that TV show, Blind Justice. And if you thought it was just a Daredevil ripoff like everyone else. Boo!
All right, guys. We are currently we're starting the third month of our Year of Alan Moore. If you're not familiar with that yet, you should go check that out at our forum. I am woefully underread in my Alan Moore. And it was actually Ryan Stegman.
I have a really good contest idea for the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. I'm going to save that. Yeah.
Great.
I'm surprising both of them with this.
Wow.
We are doing our Year of Alan Moore. We started a little early. We did December was Swamp Thing. We started a month
two
early.
Years ago.
It's a baker's year.
Yes, it's the baker's year of Alan Moore. Swamp Thing was in December. Watchmen and the Complete Ballad of Halo Jones in January. February, that's currently V for Vendetta and Skiz. And in March, get ready to read the tome. That is From
I've
Hell.
Already started. Get up in my face, people on the forum. I'm going to start posting about
we
From
do,
Hell.
We do. You know, we do need to get more active posting about the Alan Moore stuff. I've been bad about it. But April is going to see A Small Killing and Wildcats. For the full schedule, you can go to our forum. This is the last episode before we announce our winner for the Who Watches the Tom contest. So I
bought two copies of Watchmen. Mm-hmm. On accident, I was drunk. I watched football. I got excited. Brett Favre played well. That'll happen. I get home and I'm like, I'm gonna order some hardcover books. Like I will when I'm excited. So I did, and I got two of them. I'm giving one away. And by the time you listen to this. Yeah, you could still send it in, I guess. I'll be checking my email. What it is you just need to take a theme from Watchmen, compare it to a book currently. Just give me a little paragraph, just a little bit of effort. I don't demand like a huge tome, but a little bit of thought would be nice.
Actually, this is the last day. This comes out on Thursday, the 21st?
I don't know.
So... 22nd. Oh, no, they're too late.
I told there was no man.
All right.
Well, anyway, the people will announce it the following week who won, and you're going to get an Absolute Watchman. You're also going to get a great Rorschach sketch from Chris Somney, which was gorgeous.
The man who can't stop drawing.
Yeah, he can't.
All right,
and
guys.
We are all thankful of it.
Want to remind people to help us spread the Around Comics love. A few different ways that you can do that. You can help us out with our listener LCS challenge. Just go to the website, download our flyer, and ask your local comic shop owner or manager if they will be so kind as to display that in their shop. If they do, we will mention both you and the shop on the show and provide a link to the store on our site. You can also give us a dig at dig.com. You can become our virtual friend at comicspace.com/aroundcomics.
We might ask for a virtual loan of money.
Send that virtual money. You can also do my favorite, which is leave us a review at the iTunes Music Store.
Be as cool as Doom.
Doom, Andy Park, Steve Bryant, Mike Norton, and others have been so kind as to do that.
You know, Sonny LaRue.
Sonny LaRue. Bert Wheeler.
Bert Wheeler, that's right. Hey, and also, speaking of Mike Norton, I want to say we were last week we were on the Crankcast. Mike and his friend Chris Crank.
We talked about a lot of bullshit.
Yeah, we talked about a lot. If you're not sick about hearing from us already, you might want to go check that out because it was really funny. It didn't deal with comics all that much. It was a lot of other stuff.
We're talking about St. Louis style pizza.
Hey, don't knock it.
Don't knock it until you try it. But go check out the Crankcast. It's at Crankcast.
You're from Wisconsin.
Crankcast.com.
They make Provel in Wisconsin specifically for St. Louis.
Yes, exactly. They do.
And while you're going around looking at websites, you might well stop by ours. Just check out all the great things that AroundComics.com has to offer. It's your source for the best in comic book news, reviews, and opinions. While you're there, please take a minute to fill out our listener survey. It lets us know who we're talking to.
Oh, you know what?
To.
Don't read that anymore because the survey's down.
Yeah, but, did we ever get anything from the survey? Did people ever care?
Yeah, we did have a bunch of people actually fill it out, and it was almost 99% positive.
Oh, well, fuck you.
It was really good stuff. So, fuck who? What are you talking
about?
Everyone. Because they were
the 1%?
That was my immediate reaction. It's all positive.
It's all
fuck
it's all
you.
Positive. But I took it down because we don't.
You know what? Don't read it. It was boring. We didn't want to tell you before, but you shouldn't have done it before. It's boring.
We are proud members of the Comics Podcast Network. Find more great podcasts at comicspodcast.com.
And when you get bored of all the other ones, come and check out our upcoming episodes. Just so everyone is aware, we post next week's topic on Tuesdays or Wednesdays when Tom reminds Chris.
Sorry.
at our forum at aroundcomics.com. Coming in next week, we get ready for our wrap-up of the New York Comic Con. There's going to be great stories. We're going to cry. We're going to laugh.
And thanks again to Borders. Borders is your source for the best original graphic novels, manga, deluxe hardcovers, and trade paperback collections. Not only will you find exactly what you are looking for, you'll discover unexpected new authors and series. While you're at Borders, don't forget to check out their huge selection of music, movies, magazines, and more. Borders isn't just a bookstore, it has everything you need for your comics, culture, lifestyle. Google Borders for a valuable coupon, and always remember to check Borders first. Find a store near you, go to www.borderstores.com.
Every time you read that, Tom starts to crack up because I know he's thinking of the Gorder's search dragon.
Gorder's!
I found a Gorder. I offer you this to you, Gorder.
There's a site out there called gordersupply.com. It's a funeral home supplies shop.
Which you're getting so many hits right now from Australia. Only from Australia, yeah. Australia.
I'd like to thank everyone for joining us today. Big thanks to Mark Guggenheim, who was a wonderful guest, for taking the time out of his very, very busy schedule.
And I believe he said he was putting me in a part in his new show. Didn't he say that?
No, he didn't.
Well, I'm editing it in, so it sounds like he said it.
Okay. Thanks to everyone at the forum for providing some really great questions. Yeah. Thanks to Mark at Dart Tower for hosting us, as always. Sal, Tom.
Yes.
Another.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Hello?
Another one in the books. Good job, boys.
Contractual obligation.
Great. Thank you.
Oh, now you shut up. Now you're.
What do you want me to say? Great job, Chris. You were fantastic.
Fishing for comics.
This trip to New York is going to suck. I hate you guys.
All right.
Everyone have a fantastic week.
It's going to be like a couple on vacation who starts fighting at the end, but it's going to be three ways. We're all going to hate each other.
I hate you.
I hate you, man.
Fucking Tom. We'll be back again after we get back from New York, if we don't kill each other,
sooner or later,
with another new episode. In the meantime, we'll be everywhere in and around.
It's free. You can wait a couple days.
Like to suggest a topic, send us your comments, or are interested in becoming a panel member, email us at info@aroundcomics.com or visit the Contact Us section of our website. Music for the show provided by the Podshow Podsafe Music Network, music.podshow.com. Views expressed in the interviews or by guests of the show are solely those of the individuals expressing them and do not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Thank you for listening today, and remember to join us next time when the panel will change, but our mission will stay the same. Bringing you the very best news, reviews, and opinions in and around comics. Around Comics is a Pipe Dream production. Copyright 2007, all rights reserved. Love you, babe. Yeah.